That was Nicol. Yeah, third.
Okay. We don't need to demote them.
Okay. I mean, if they figured out how to avoid leaks and time leaks in Haskell, maybe that that would promote them. So you want to go in place order?
What do you think?
I can just call out.
Let's go in alphabetic order, and then I'll just do everybody at the end.
Okay.
Okay, it's 11:10. Let's get started. Laptop, are you plugged in?
Yeah, should be.
Did you do the right?
Yeah, might have actually.
Sorry, we're just dealing with technicalities here. While Phil gets the screen up, there we go.
Well, I don't think it's configured for the right size. Do you know how big that screen actually is?
No idea. Phil is now attempting to guess the size of resolution of that screen so that Windows can get it right. This is an example of good design for you, by the way. On a Apple laptop, if you plug it in to a display, almost always it will work out what the size of the display is automatically. On a Windows laptop, you have to tell it what the size is. So you should think about that, about how to design things. You'll all know that your laptops come with power supplies. Those power supplies are designed so that if you plug them in anywhere in the world, they adjust and give the right flow of voltage to your laptop. Those power supplies were designed by hardware engineers. We know what would happen if that same power supply had been designed by a software engineer. You would first need to bring up a menu on your machine, say what power you were plugging it into, and if you got it wrong, your computer would literally fry. And a little notice would come up saying, sorry, your computer is fried because you've picked the wrong voltage. Please don't do that again. So keep that in mind when you're designing your own user interfaces. Right, are we ready to go?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, we have here the entrance in this year's Informatics One Functional Programming Competition. We also have here the winners of this year's Informatics One Functional Programming Competition. This year, something that has happened that has never happened before. We had 8 entries. That was a relatively small number of entries. We've had more in previous years with smaller classes. But of the 8 entries we had, every single one of them was judged worthy of an award. We've given 7 awards in the past. Nice, because it's 2 to the n minus 1 for n equals 3. But this year, 8's good too. It's 2 to the n for n equals 3. So we get every single one of these has an award, but we're going to go through them in alphabetic order, and then you'll find out there's 1 first place, 4 second places, and 3 third places. But all of these, every single person who entered really is to be congratulated, because all of these are wonderful. Okay, so do you want to go through these?
Okay, so first off we've got, you're going to have to forgive me if I get name pronunciation wrong, Victor Inza. So this was a...
Is Victor Inza here?
Hey. So I've got three samples. I think only one of these was the one you intended to produce. So we've got a Edinburgh University logo, but the cool thing is, was that the this program also converted arbitrary strings to logo text.
Logo graphics, which was really cool. Cheers.
So logo means the turtles that you use for drawing L systems in your tutorial.
Yeah. So what I could do is I could just take a quote from Wiki and get it rendered in the logo, which is really cool. Next off, we got Moving Infinity by Niklaus Huber. Hey, cool. So this was much more exciting than this. I'll quickly bring up the actual program. So this was, in fact, an animated graphic, using OpenGL. So nice little use of colors there. Next, got Chinwenwe Kadzua. Hey, how's it going? So this was an SVG program. So this wasn't using the L system stuff. This was actually producing SVG output to create fractals. And it includes animation as well, which is really cool. You won't be able to get this running on all browsers, unfortunately. We couldn't get this to run under DICE, because I don't think Firefox has got the latest version of SVG.
So for those who don't know, SVG is a fairly recent graphics format, and it's used in web browsers. And as you can see, it can be animated.
Next, Jonas Olsen. Hey. So here we've got another SVG example. So this was really cool. This one had a data type for simple SVG graphics, and then it produced arbitrary SVG images with it. And it had some code to generate, I don't know what sort of fractals they're officially called. You said it was based on Descartes' theorem? Okay.
It probably has some name, but they haven't bothered to check it out.
Cool. So we could call it Descartes Fractal, maybe, for now. You could specify some command line parameters to draw different sorts of variations on this fractal. Next, Marionis Petrauskas. Hey. And this is a really nice looking image. This was an example of a complex function rendered with some nicer, very nice coloring.
It actually looks nicer on that screen than on that screen, but there you go. By the way, these are all up on the linked to the Informatics One webpage, so do go and have a look, and all the code is there as well, if you want to see how these are written. Many of them do have code as beautiful as the images.
Next, Jordan Stoyanov. And here we go. So this, I don't know quite how to start explaining this. So these are examples of three-dimensional fractals, which have been ray traced with shadowing. Clearly very, very impressive. And you can give arbitrary arguments to generate all sorts of fractals there. So it's a version of the Mandelbrot set, but it's done as a three-dimensional version. Hey.
Is it possible to see that generated?
Yes, I mean, the code's there, so I would recommend running and having a go with it. Unfortunately, maybe we need to look at some optimization, because it would takes a few minutes to run. But I mean, it's a hard problem, it's having to compute. And Claudio. So, Maddie. Hey, how's it going? So, this is using L systems to create an images of the four seasons. So, this is just using the L systems stuff that you had in tutorial 7, and
there's an astonishing amount of detail here. It's really good to have a look at the code as well. There's even a lens flare, which is really cool.
So next year, when I lecture on, you remember there's a seasons data type? Now I have the right illustration for it.
And finally, Eurus Ubatus. Hey, and here we go. This is the Mandelbrot set. And here's a small fraction of it. But I think your program could render any part of the Mandelbrot set, right?
Yeah.
So I should have probably actually got some more samples for this. But yes, this renders it in high resolution, produce a nice little lightning coloring around it.
Okay, so would everybody who entered please come down? And would everybody else please give them, well, everybody come down. So, I'm going to start with third place and work up. So in third place, people get 10-pound book tokens. So our awards are sponsored by Galois. They are a firm that produces software. They were founded by John Launchbury, who used to be a colleague of mine at Glasgow University when we were first developing Haskell. And indeed, Galois writes a lot of its software in Haskell. They also implement programming languages on top of Haskell, typically things for cryptography that are then used by the NSA in the US. The NSA would be the, where are the spooks here called? National Security Administration. What are the spooks here called? Not MI5, the ones, not MI6, the special research facility where they do cryptography. Not Bletchley Park, the modern equivalent. Can't remember the name. Anyhow, the NSA are the spooks in the US that do cryptography. So Haskell is used as spyware. Let's see. Third place goes to Victor Inza. Third place to Niklas Kruba. And third place to Chimamue Kazuha. Well done. You don't have a camera, do you?
I'm sorry.
Second place goes to Claudio Tarlingiano. Sorry, Claudio. Well done. Mero Jonas Patraskas. Joris Urbatis. And Jonas Olsen. The second place winners all get 15-pound book tokens. And a 25-pound book token goes to Jordan Stoyanov. There you go. There's a 3D jury appearance. So. Okay. Okay, so I promised you some interesting technical material for today, and that's what we're going to have. But of course, before I do that, I want to deal with any questions. Yesterday, one person came up to me after my talk, and they mentioned another talk that it reminded them of. It's a really interesting talk, so I'll remind all you of it if you don't know of it. It's called The Last Lecture. It's by a fellow who was on the faculty at Carnegie Mellon called Randy Pausch. The Last Lecture was a series that they gave, and the idea was, if you had to give your last lecture, what would you put in it? Randy Pausch had cancer. It was his last lecture. And it was his version of advice on how to live your life. So I strongly urge you to have a look at that if you have a chance. It's about an hour long. It's easy to find on the web. And it's a different take on what to do with your life, but equally interesting. Right. Any other questions? Now is your last chance. So today we're going to learn why Haskell is called Haskell, and I don't think I've worn my actual tie for you before. I just showed you a picture of it, but I'm wearing it today. There it is. I also have my lambda pin. So this tie was made for me by my wife many years ago, and this pin was made by DeLeslie Hutchins, one of my PhD students. And what I'm going to do is teach you some history. So I mentioned yesterday that the stored program computer is well under 100 years old still. But we're actually going to go back a little bit farther than that and look at the foundations of logic and their relevance to what we've been learning in the course. And the goal of this lecture will be, in fact, by the end of it, you will see that the two halves of the course, which you thought were separate, computation and logic and functional programming, are two sides of the same coin. So let's go back to Boolean algebra, right? We have the Boolean data type, true and false in Haskell. You've been learning about true and false in computation and logic. And why is it called Boolean? It's named after this man, George Boole, who wrote a book called The Laws of Thought. He first wrote a short paper in 1847 called Mathematical Analysis of Logic. And he says he takes various, he actually is going back to the form of logic they had before they could write it as formulas in the Middle Ages, and what they had to do is they had to have standard fixed forms that they would reason with, such as all x's are y's, no x's are y's, and so on. And he showed how to encode these in Boolean logic. So to say all x's are y's, you'd say x and not y, which was written as 1 minus y, because x, so because 0 was false and 1 was true. And he used multiplication for and addition for or. So, and subtraction from 1 for negation. So he said x and 1 minus y is 0, that is false, means that all x's are y's. That is, whenever x is true, it can't be both the case that x is true and y is false, because then the product would be 1, which is different from 0. So saying it's not the case that x is true and y is false. Rather long-winded way of doing it. So he could only think of this as a kind of arithmetic. Abstract algebra had just been developed, which is what made him do this. Now, so that was a paper in 1847 called The Mathematical Analysis of Logic. And 7 years later, he published this book, The Laws of Thought. And it's quite interesting, right? He has in it things like proposition 4, that axiom of metaphysicians, which is termed the principle of contradiction, and which affirms that it is impossible for any being to possess a quality and at the same time not to possess it, is a consequence of the fundamental law of thought, whose expression is x squared equals x. So why would x squared equals x be the fundamental law of thought? Well, because the only solutions to that are x is 0 or x is 1. So this is how he was restricting himself to truth values. And then he gives a little proof of this. So all he's saying here is, X and not X is false, which is one of the rules you learned in computation and logic. And he gives here a proof of it, but it's a bit of, we wouldn't accept this as a proof today. So he says, well, X squared equals X is the same as X minus X squared equals zero. So that's okay to do for arithmetic, but notice that in logic, if we were doing that, what we'd be doing is saying and not on both sides of the equation. So what he's got here is X squared and not X squared is the way we'd write it in logic, which he then rewrites to zero. But wait a minute, that's what we're trying to prove, is that you can rewrite that to zero. So this wouldn't really be accepted as a proof today, but he put it forward as a proof. So in modern terms, Boole, who gets enshrined as a type in our programming languages, was a crank. Okay. But actually he had deep insight. Even though he got this technically wrong, he got a lot right, and this enabled us to move forward and improve. So the whole notion of dealing with logic symbolically comes down to Boole. Okay, so that's Boole. And one thing I want you to get from this is the time scale. So that was around the 1850s. And now, let's skip to Gottlob Frege, a noted anti-Semite, by the way. And in 1879, he published a book called The Begriffsschrift, The Foundations of Arithmetic. And here's his notation for writing modus ponens. So this thing on the top, said that little hook means implies. So that's his way of saying B implies A. And this thing here is his way of saying B. And then this vertical line means from this you may conclude A. So he's saying if you know B implies A and you know B, then you can conclude A. In our modern notation, we would write it this way. Notice that he writes this a line with this stroke next to it. That stroke was called the truth stroke. That was his way of asserting, without the line, it's just saying, this is the idea of a B. But if you put that stroke next to it, then you're asserting B is true. And if you look at this, it should look very similar to something that you've been using in logic a lot, the turnstile symbol, right? The sideways T. And this is where it comes from. He also was the first person to introduce quantifiers for all. And the way he wrote for all was as this little dip in a line with a variable on top of it. So this actually is his way of saying, for all A, phi of A holds. So the rule says here, if you know that A implies phi of A, so big A implies phi of little a, and little a is a variable, it doesn't appear in big A, then you can conclude, well, since we can prove phi of A, and we don't know anything about A, then it must be true for all A. So that's what he's written here. A implies for all A, phi of A. And again, in modern terms, we would write it like this. It got slightly more complicated. People normally giggle when I say that. What he did was he wrote out lots of formulas, and he was actually trying to define the definition of natural numbers. He was trying to explain what natural numbers were. And he explained them by introducing logic, so he could then write down a principle of induction, and he said the natural numbers are those things which satisfy the principle of induction. That is, if you can prove something for true, and if for all n, you can prove it for n, then you can prove it for n plus 1, then it holds for all n. Those things for which induction of that form works are the natural numbers. That was a very deep insight, very important. I am in awe that he could think to do this, right? Because as important as logic and the principle of induction are, they are more complicated, less obvious than the notion of the natural numbers themselves. So why you would want to invent these things to define natural numbers is something that I wouldn't think to do. But I guess this is why Frege is much more of a genius than I am, because he did think to do this. And it turned out to be the foundations of logic and to be very significant. So in modern notation, these were all the axioms in Frege's work. The law of modus ponens, right? This is familiar to all of you from computation and logic, more or less. Right? If you know B implies A and you know B, you can conclude A. Right? You've been doing that a lot. And then he had three axioms. A implies B implies A. What? Well, okay, if you know A, then it must be true that B implies A because you know A, so A is true. And let's see. C implies B implies A implies C implies B implies C implies A. Well, I'll let you go off and prove that one for yourself, but it happens that it is true. And C implies B implies A implies B implies C implies A, which is also true. Turns out of these three axioms, from modus ponens in these two, you can actually prove the third one. So he'd not recognized that one of his axioms was redundant. But this is what he came. So these are all true, and it turns out these are sufficient to prove everything you'd want to prove, but that's not completely obvious. So various different formulations of logic were tried over the next few years. So notice was a 30-year gap between Boole and Frege. So now, let's just wait another 50 years, and we get to Gerhard Gentzen. So Gerhard Gentzen, right, normally you disparage people by saying, that man's a Nazi. That man's a Nazi. He was. He joined the SS. Oddly, though, he wanted to study logic. The leading proponent of logic at the time was Hilbert. Hilbert's student was, I think, Bernays, a Jew. And so because he wanted to learn about logic, he studied underneath a Jew and got in trouble with all his friends in the Nazi party. And as we'll see, that affected him. So here's the rules from his 1934 papers. This is 50 years after Frege. So it took 50 years to get these ideas right. And these are, in fact, exactly the way. So there are various ways of presenting the rules of logic. And you saw one form called sequent calculus in computation and logic. That comes from this 1934 paper by Gentzen. He, in fact, gave both of the major forms of logic we use today, sequent calculus being one of them, and natural deduction being the other. And he's written down natural deduction exactly the same way we would write it down today, except he wrote the letters in German. So the A's and B's and so on there are German A's and B's. But the rest of it is exactly the symbols that we would use today. So he uses this backward C for implies. He uses an upside down A for all. This was the paper that introduced using an upside down A for all. Backwards E had been used for there exists, but he was the one, right? And of course, you couldn't use a backwards A for all, because a backwards A is an A. But they were using upside down E, so he worked out, backwards E, so he worked out you could use an upside down A. Uses the modern symbol for OR, and most people now write a wedge symbol, an upside down OR for the AND, but actually it's much easier to read an ampersand, and people who know what they're doing write ampersand rather than an upside down OR symbol for AND. So this is exactly modern notation. Here's the way we would write it today with the A's and B's now in English rather than in German. And these are the rules of natural deduction. So this rule says if you assume A, and assuming A you can prove B, then you know that A implies B. That makes sense. This rule says, this one we've seen before, modus ponens. If you know A implies B and you know A, then you know B. Notice the nice symmetry of these rules. This bit is called the hypothesis. This is called the conclusion. This rule has A implies B in the conclusion. So it's how to build the proposition A implies B. This rule has A implies B in a hypothesis. So it's how to make use of the proposition A implies B. So this is how you would know that A implies B is true. This is what you could do with it once you know it's true. And all his rules, you note, come in pairs like that. So the rule for AND says, if you can prove A and you can prove B, hey presto, then you can prove A and B. That makes sense. This rule says if you can prove A and B, then you can conclude A. This rule says if you can prove A and B, then you can conclude B. Here's a very simple use of those in a proof. Let's say I wanted to prove that B and A implies A and B. Well, how would I prove that? Well, let's assume B and A. But we know that from B and A, you can conclude A. We also know that from B and A, you can conclude B. We now have a proof of A and a proof of B, so we've proved A and B, but we assumed B and A, so we now know that we can get rid of that assumption. We can say, well, without assuming anything, we know B and A implies A and B. So notice in this little rule, you label your assumptions with a name. Here the name is X. You label the use of this rule with an X, and you're said to discharge that assumption. You can discharge zero or more occurrences of an assumption. So here there are two occurrences that are being discharged by using this rule, which indeed has a little, so those are Z superscripts there and a Z superscript there. And he also came, well, so I mentioned that he came up with two major forms of logic, natural deduction, which we've just been looking at, and sequent calculus that you've looked at before. What he was interested in was simplifying proofs. And the reason he wanted to simplify proofs is he wanted to say, if you prove something, the proof only depends on parts of that formula. That's called the subformula property. So he had to simplify things. So here's a proof. From A and B, I can conclude A implies B, and here's a proof of A, and then I get a proof of B. Now the proof of B here includes the formula somewhere in it, A implies B. A implies B is bigger than B. So now we've proved something, but to prove it, we needed a bigger formula, a different formula. He wanted to show that every proof only involved subformulas. So B is a subformula of A implies B, but not conversely. Right? The subformulas of A implies B are A and B and their subformulas. So what he did is he said, well, look, if you do have a proof that looks like this, you can simplify it. The way you would simplify it is, here we're assuming A. Don't assume A. Every place you're assuming A, copy in the actual proof of A. So here's a proof with no assumptions. Doesn't need the formula A implies B. A now might get copied many times, right? We had two assumptions in the thing we had before, right? So if you do this lots of times, you can get a much larger proof by doing a lot of copying. So this might make the proof bigger, but it's simpler. Similarly, if you have a proof of A and B, well, that'll be a proof of A and a proof of B. And if from A and B you conclude A, well, we can simplify that proof, right? Just use the proof of A directly. And that will actually always be smaller as well. Now, Gentzen didn't actually see this way of simplifying proofs. That's why he invented natural that's why he invented sequent calculus, was as a way of doing, of showing the subformula property. But Provitz later showed this much in this much more direct way. Now, why did he want the subformula property? Let's see. Right, you could then take arbitrarily complicated proofs. So there is our proof. Here's our proof that B and A implies A and B. Here's a proof from the assumptions B and A of B and A. So here's, did those get discharged? No. So this is a proof, a rather complicated proof, that from the assumptions B and A, I can conclude A and B. Right? But we could simplify that using the rules we saw. Just take this and substitute it for both of those assumptions. And now we've got two things that look like the form of AND that we had, and those simplify down. So here's a direct proof that from the assumptions A and B, you can prove A and B. So that's a nice thing to know, that you could always simplify proofs. But he was particularly interested in it because he wanted to show that the only thing you had in the proofs were the parts of it. He was particularly interested to prove that you could never prove false. Right? That would be a good property of a logic, right? That doesn't let you prove false. And the subformula property was very important in this because what are all the subformulas of false? It doesn't have any, right? The only subformula of false is false itself. And then all you need to do is go through the actual proof rules, discover none of them has false on the bottom. Sorry, none of them in a simplified form has false on the bottom. And therefore, there is no proof of false. So this subformula property was very important in showing that there's no way to prove false, that his logic is consistent. I quite like this idea of the subformulas of false, right? It's sort of like, what part of no don't you understand? Now, we'd had to wait 50 years chunks before, but at the same time that Gentzen was doing all that, Alonzo Church was creating, ta-da, the lambda calculus. So going back to Frege, there was interest in notions of function in logic. And so Church tried to encode the notion of function. And he came up with this very simple idea of saying, right, well, we'll have something that tells you what the bound variable is, and then you'll have a term in terms of that bound variable. So here it is, there, the very first use of lambda in lambda calculus, to say, well, you can form things of the form lambda x m, where m is an arbitrary term. So m might be x times x, and lambda x times x is the squaring function. And then he gave reduction rules. Actually, he could define pairs in terms of functions. We're not going to do that. So, but the basic idea is the key reduction rule, we've seen this before, is if you've got lambda xu applied to t, what does the stupid computer do? It takes t and it copies it for x everywhere x appears in u. And we write that using substitution, u with t substituted for x. And then these others, right, will be very obvious to you. First of a pair, t and u, is t, and second of a pair, t and u, is, of course, u. So taking pairs and first and second as primitives, we would get that. So our only primitives here are function application, lambda expressions, function application, pair formation, and first and second. So here's an example of simplifying a term. The term lambda z, second of z, first of z, a pair to apply to y and x. So now we take the pair yx, and we replace both instances of z by that, right? So we get second yx and first of yx. Right, you all know how to do that, but you know you need a voice like this to do that kind of thing. So let's see, what have we got? Second of y and x, that would be the second one, that's x. And first of y and x, that would be the first one, which is y. So that would be x paired with y. Oh. So you can see that this is the function that just takes a tuple and flips it about. Now, it turned out, so he said, look, we can use this as a basis for logic, but it turned out that was an inconsistent logic. It was a logic where you could prove false, which is not a good thing. So he needed to refine it, and he refined it by adding a type system. So in the type system, he said, well, if x is a variable of type A and u is a term of type B, then lambda xu is, of course, a function from A to B. So this is exactly what we would do with Haskell, except we would write this colon as two colons, and we would write this thing as an arrow. And if s is a term of a function from A to B, and t is a term of type A, of course, s applied to t is a term of type B. So this is just function application. For pairs, right, if t has type A and u has type B, then tu is an AB pair. So we would write this open parenthesis A comma B, close parenthesis. He's writing it with an and between them. And if S has type A and B, then first of S, of course, has type A, and second of S has type B. So this is just the typing rules for functions, function application, building a pair, and taking components of a pair. So now, here's the same program we had before. Here is its, here's the derivation showing that it's well typed, right? So if Z has type B of A, then second of Z has type A, and first of Z has type B, and then second Z paired with first Z has type A and B, and so lambda Z, second of Z, first Z, has type B and A implies A and B. And notice that if we have a function applied to a term, we can just substitute the term for each occurrence of X. Why will that be well typed? Well, this is well typed because X has type A. On that assumption, U has type B. So lambda X U has type A implies B. Therefore, if we substitute a term T of type A for X, this is still well typed because X has type A and the term also has type A. Similarly, if T has type A and U has type B, well, then TU has type A and B, first has type A. Well, wait a minute. If we just pick T, it does have type A. So this remains well typed. So applying these simplifying rules, we can simplify our proof that this term is well typed to show that the final term is well typed. So this says, as you reduce a program, the type of the program stays the same. This is something that we have assumed without any kind of proof throughout the term, right? That as we do these substitutions, as the stupid computer takes a well-typed Haskell program and substitutes the argument for the formal variable, it stays well-typed. This is why. So that proof goes back to Church, 1940. So what's happened here? You have Boole, you wait 30 years, you have Frege, you wait 50 years, you then get Gentzen on the one hand and Church on the other hand. Then what happens? Just wait a while longer. And you get the Curry-Howard isomorphism. So I was writing implies, and here's your upside down wedge for and, right? But we normally would write these often as an arrow for functions and a cross symbol, multiplication for pairs. And these all correspond to operations in logic. It turns out summation of types also corresponds to logic. The empty type corresponds to false in logic. So this was discovered by Haskell Curry and William Howard. Haskell Curry's died, so if you look on the web, you find out when he was born. William Howard hasn't died yet, so I can't find out when he was born. And Haskell Curry is, of course, the man that Haskell is named after. So Curry wrote out a correspondence between a logic and a programming language. He first worked this out in the 40s, I think. And then Howard took what Curry had done and adjusted it to work with lambda calculus. And he did this in the early 70s, but the paper didn't appear till 1980. You remember the other work we saw appeared 1935, 1940. So you wait 40 years before this precise correspondence between what Church did and what Gentzen did was discovered. Now you've seen the correspondence, right? Right, so you saw that, right? I want you to put on your special colored glasses that let you only see blue and erase the red. And if you put on those special colored glasses, of course what you see is that. So I presented this in a way that makes it completely obvious that what Gentzen's formulation of logic is doing and what Church's formulation of type lambda calculus are doing are exactly the same thing. So lambda calculus and logic are literally the same. I was going to say are literally two sides of the same coin, but that's not literal. That's a metaphor. And notice also that this operation of simplifying a proof in logic corresponds exactly to what the stupid computer does when it executes a program. So evaluating a program and simplifying a proof are exactly the same thing. So the formulas of logic are types. A proof in logic corresponds to a term in lambda calculus. And there it is, Howard wrote it out in very similar to modern notation, with this being Gentzen's notation for the logic, this being the type rules for lambda calculus, and then he just laid out, look, of course these are in one-to-one correspondence. And then he went on to say, well, in that case, what would quantifiers in the logic correspond to as types in a programming language? And he invented what's called dependent types, which are just the types you get from looking at quantifiers in logic. And then, for instance, Gordon Plotkin here wrote a lovely paper in the early 1980s, pointing out that the abstract data types that we've been talking about in this course, in fact, correspond exactly to existentials in a logic. So it turns out that this correspondence goes on and on and on. There are lots of things that correspond. Monads, it turns out, correspond to a modal logic. So let me tell you about aliens. We have tried to communicate at various times in our lives with aliens, right? We actually, this is a plaque that's on the side of the Voyager spaceship. And this is saying, here's our sun, here are other suns next to it, here's what we look like. This is a silhouette of the Voyager behind, so you can see that how big we are. Here's a diagram of our solar system, we're this planet here. Now, if you imagine if aliens look at this, some bits of it, like straight lines, they will probably understand, and distances, right? These are proportional to distances. So probably, and these numbers on them are binary numbers, the frequencies of certain pulsars. So you can identify these pulsars and know that Sol is that distance away from the various pulsars. They can probably work that out, regardless of what they're like. Now, if they look at this bit, they may or may not be able to work that out. Right? If Star Trek is correct, they'll just look at it and go, they're exactly like us, except they don't have pubic hair. Maybe they'll just look at that and go, yummy. Right, where's that planet? Right, we don't know what they will do. But they might, you know, this part they almost certainly will be able to decode. This part they might or might not be able to decode. Now let's look at aliens in popular culture. The film Independence Day involved destroying various large buildings. This film was released in 1996. So this was before we had the images ingrained in our mind of the two towers coming down. This is when we would destroy large buildings for fun. And in that movie, they destroyed the aliens. How did they destroy the aliens? They wrote a computer virus that the alien computer then caught. And I was really excited by this because I had just moved to Bell Labs. I mentioned yesterday working at Bell Labs. C came from Bell Labs, and this has lots of curly braces in it. It's rather a strange computer program. It only has open curly braces, not the closed ones. But it was very clearly from the curly braces, it was written in C. Now, Java had been invented then. Java inherited the curly braces from C. But I figured this couldn't be Java because this was back in 1996, which was before Java had spread through the known universe. So it must have been C that they were using to give a deadly virus to this alien computer. Now, is it likely that an alien computer would be running C? Precisely, right? C has lots of arbitrary choices in it. It's impossible that it could be running C, because how could aliens end up making those same arbitrary choices? But, right, what about lambda calculus? If we tried to communicate with the aliens in lambda calculus, would it be like these straight lines, something that they could understand, or like this, something that was maybe rather arbitrary and that they might not understand? Would aliens understand lambda calculus? I would claim yes. If they understood basic logic, if they understood that if you know A implies B and you know A, then you know B, then they would understand lambda calculus. So I tried to summarize this by saying lambda calculus is universal. And then I realized that calling lambda calculus universal is way too limiting. Because if you think about a law like modus ponens, even if you can imagine a different universe with a different gravitational constant or a different speed of light, I can imagine such a universe. Maybe you can too. I cannot imagine a universe where if you know A implies B and you know A, then you don't know B. So even if there are other universes, I expect lambda calculus must make sense in them. And after many years of trying to find a good English word, I gave up. And one of my students proposed the word omniversal. So lambda calculus isn't just universal, it is omniversal. So I want to give special thanks to Phil Scott. Oops, this is the wrong version. Zoe was last year. Kirsten, Kamiz, and Ewan. To my son and daughter, Adam and Leora, who inspired me, and to you, but I'm going to leave off this dedication for a moment. I want to explain one other thing to you. Right? I showed you lambdas, right? And you remember seeing lambdas with monads. One thing that we didn't pick up on there is, right, the fact that you could write the lambdas, remember we had this funny double greater than equal thing and then a lambda after that? If you didn't have lambdas, it would be really hard to do that. Once you have lambda, you can say, oh, I'll make up some other notation for that and then do it. But having lambdas were absolutely central to coming up with that idea of monads. Once you had it, you could then invent better notation. Now, that whole thing got into not Java, but Microsoft's competitor for Java, C Sharp. So C Sharp actually supports monads. It's something called LINQ. And to support, they had to do the same thing. They had to put lambda expressions in it and so on. Right? So the next time you've got a hard problem, what do I want you to think? I want you to think, this is a job for C Sharp. I'm not sure this is going to work, right? But there's one other thing I want you to think. Right? What's behind C Sharp? What makes the LINQ part of C Sharp works? Of course, behind every good idea is lambda calculus! And so the last part of the dedication is to you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your excellent questions. And thank you especially for the future that you are going to go out and create. Right? It took 30 years to get from Boole to Frege, 30 years more to get to Church and Gensen, 30 years more to get to Curry Howard, 40 years after that, we first had Haskell. We're now 20 years on from Haskell. We've got another 20 years to go, right? These things tend to go in 50-year cycles. Right? So that gives you 20 years to come up with the next big thing, and I'm expecting it from you. Thank you very much.
Bit of an awesome twist there as well. Wasn't expecting that. Ah, no. Serious.
Yeah. Oh, that's sad. I saw you had a question, but I didn't have time to answer it.
Tell me what's the name, sorry?
Yeah, Peter Henderson.
I'm really sorry about that.
That's all right.
A function returns body, and the subfunction returns an error. Can it catch that error, or does it just end the whole function and output the error?
The answer is sort of yes and no. For general Haskell, the answer is no, but if you're working in the IO monad, the answer is yes.
Okay.
So if something's type, it's the IO monad thing, you can catch and deal with those errors.
Oh, sorry, sorry, can I just get your name? Peter Henderson.
Yeah.
Okay, what was the email titled?
N1 programming compression entry or something like
that. Damn.
Do you want me to send it to you again? See if it comes through.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I honestly haven't, I'm sure I didn't receive it. Peter Henderson.
Yeah. Sorry.
What's the student number?
S111705.
S111705.
No. And you sent it to me, did you?
Phil Scott. Phil.scott at
ed.ac.uk.
Yeah.
And it was it was title competition something or other.
Competition entry or something
like that. No, I mean,
I might have sent it to env.ed.ac.uk.
No. Okay.
My fault then.
Could you send it to me again anyway?
Yeah, I'll send it to you again.
Please, right, sorry about that.